This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Depends on what he's
talking
about.
It's interesting to see if people need kind of structure and guidance and stuff.
Yeah,
is that what his main kind of message is about?
Yeah, I mean, that's what his books are about. Yeah. 12 rules and 12 more rules. It's all about rules for life. That's what they are. And the things that he mentions, almost all of them in the first book are okay with Islam. In the second book, there's a couple of things that he's like abandoned ideology, which, like, is, to be frank, ridiculous. Because what do we mean by ideas, ideologies? Is it a system of set of ideas, or what is it we're talking about? And obviously, you can argue that there's nothing that does not have an ideology. Mm-hmm. Everything is driven by some sort of lens that you're looking at the world through. So for him to write abandon ideology, but in other places, he talks about individualism, and he speaks about individualism, in a positive sense. Because that's an ideology. I mean, individualism. I'm not saying that the thing is, you can't really put him in a box, Peterson. It would be wrong to say that he's an individualist. Mm-hmm. Just like it would probably be wrong to, some people call him a classical liberal. There's truth in that he obviously believes in aspects of the liberal tradition and aspects of individualism. However, he's not easily put into a box, because if you look at his latest book, he talks a lot about institutions. I think one of his rules was something to do with preserving institutions and following them. So that's more of a collectivist discourse, a communitarian, you could say. Not collectivist, but I'll say it's a communitarian discourse. So from that perspective,
liberals aren't traditionally anti-communitarian institutions.
I'm with you. But what I'm saying is, it's difficult to put him in that kind of easy box. But what I will say is that saying abandon ideology is almost an untenable venture from the...
I mean, there's probably some specific meaning he must...
He meant it in that way. He definitely meant it in that way. Which...
Even it's abandon ideology, even my own.
Yeah, I mean, abandon... Think about it. It's ironic because it's prescriptive itself.
Yeah.
And ideologies are more normative and prescriptive. So if you say abandon ideology, the irony in it is that, well, that could be an ideological statement. The statement itself is ideological. Yeah.
What do you think his detractors and kind of dislike about him? And did you have any backlash from your discussion with him?
I'm sure some... I mean, he has different detractors. Mm-hmm. Not everyone that disagrees with him is wrong. I mean, like I said, these kind of things that we're just talking about here, there's some, if you look at his philosophical thoughts and, ideas, mm-hmm. some of them are really dysfunctional. They don't work together. For example, his pragmatism on the one hand, I don't want to get into it, it's a very long story, but he has ideas which don't, he's a pragmatist on the one hand, but on the other, pragmatism is basically saying that truth with a capital T doesn't exist out there in the real world in a correspondence theory type way.
Oh, okay.
But on the other hand, if you look at his books and how he expresses psychological discussion, he'll critique a theory based on its lack of evidence. But that presupposes a correspondence theory of...
there is some kind of reality.
Outside, correspondence theory of epistemology, right? So his epistemology is pragmatism when he talks about religion, but for all intents and purposes, although he doesn't spell out in this way, it's correspondence when he's doing his psychology. Mm. So there is a tension there, and I don't think he's got it all mapped out. And in fact, there was one particular discussion with Sam Harris that he had, not the three or four major ones that he had, because I watched all these things, and there was one particular one where he was actually speaking about... Sam Harris actually brought this up to him. He said to him, I want to try and remember exactly the words that he used. He said, you can believe in what you believe in, but it will be at your peril. And then Jordan Peterson responded, and this is, by the way, it's not even there's no video of this, it's all audio. It's a podcast on Sam Harris's thing. And then Jordan Peterson responds to it, and he says, it has been at my peril. It's very interesting. One of the most telling things I've ever seen or heard from Jordan Peterson. Because he's admitting a toil, a situation of where he's in a toil because he doesn't have his epistemology worked out. And you can see that he works in this way where, for example, he approaches religion in a certain manner, where he wants truth to be malleable and flexible. But then, once again, in his practice, he's not like that. You know, in, talk about psychology, he's not like that. And I think this is causing him some level of cognitive dissonance. There is a problem here in the way in which he conceptualizes faith.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
Yeah, and, yeah, I did say that, but I didn't spell it out. And that's why you'll see that, for example, in his Genesis series, which I watched, actually, you know, his biblical series and stuff, because, you know, I was preparing for it. I watched everything. And in his biblical series, you'll see that he's metaphorizing the text, okay? And at one point, he actually does quote Origen of Alexandria.
What's that?
Origen of Alexandria was an ecclesiastical church writer, one of the most voluminous of his kind in the first 300 years of Christianity. I think he died 250 after the disappearance of Jesus. And he was a representative of the Alexandrian school of exegesis. And this school was known for what they were called spiritualizing the text, doing ta'wil, basically, you know, majaz, that the text is metaphoric. And Origen of Alexandria, I did some work on him when I was at the University of Oxford. Actually, I did one particular study on him and looking at how he, compared to other church writers, they conceive of the text. Yeah, and basically, the Alexandrian school was atypical, it was aberrational compared to the other schools in exegesis, in tafsir.
So they're heretical.
Well, I mean, there was something called the Origen crisis. So he was not made a saint in the Catholic Church or the Orthodox Church, which is why he's referred to not as a church father, but as an ecclesiastic church writer. Having said that, that Origen crisis happened, by the way, after his death, I think somewhere in the 4th century. But the point is that he quoted him, Peterson quoted Origen of Alexandria, maybe in his 3rd or 4th lecture on the topic, because he was aware of the spiritualizing impact or approach that Origen of Alexandria has to the text. However, I came across a particular extract where Origen of Alexandria was having a discussion with an apologist who was a Greek, someone who believed in Platonism, I think, right? You know, Platonist, who wasn't a Christian. And he said to him, his name was Celsus, C-E-L-S-U-S, yeah? And he said to him, how could it be that, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but how could it be that your God died on the cross, basically?
Okay, maqala.
Yeah, something like that, right? And then he said... And then Origen of Alexandria said, the events of the crucifixion, not all of them must be read like literally, and that some of it has to be spiritualized, basically. The point is that I'm making, if you do spiritualize the text, if you spiritualize the text, meaning metaphorize it, at the rate and the frequency and the degree, and using the same kind of hermeneutical approach, someone like Origen of Alexandria was using in the early days, because that's the only precedent they really have. He had a teacher called Philo, who was a Jew, by the way, but he had the same kind of approach, standard approach to the biblical text. But if you follow that line of reasoning, then the crucifixion itself could be something which is called into question. The crucifixion itself, which means Christianity becomes a myth. The entire religion of Christianity becomes a myth. The crucifixion, the resurrection, the ascension, all these doctrines that we have to, the incarnation. So why is that all not mythological? In fact, what makes us think that one is mythological and the other one is not? If this is all etiology, the idea of myth, you know, then why do we discriminate in what we render as a myth and what we render as possible? So I think that Jordan Peterson, because he mentions this in Maps of Meaning, the big beginning of one of his books, he mentions that when he was a young man, you know, he got doubts of Christianity because of the biblical narrative of Genesis in particular. And there's a reason for that. The reason for that is because it's obviously not commensurate with the scientific method or anything scientific. But it's completely away from it. So this is, I'm thinking to myself, because he's a religious man in many ways, right? He doesn't say it, and even doesn't answer, never answered once, whether he believes in God in a yes or no fashion. Never. The maximum he's ever said is, I act as if I believe in God. That's why I never asked him that question, or never even engaged him, because I know he doesn't want to answer that question, you see. Mm. But having said that, that's his answer. His answer is, I act as if I believe in, or as I act as if God exists.
Mm.
But despite that, he's a religious man, in the sense that he does obviously see there's a meaningfulness to the Christian tradition in particular, comparative to other traditions, you see. So why is he not speaking about the Vedas, for example? Why is he not speaking about Hercules and Zeus? Why are these sets of myths, Western myths, better than these other sets of myths?
Because that's his background.
There must be something about these myths which make, there must be a truth about these myths which make these other sets of myths less truthful, or not as valuable, or not as worthy of being exegeted or studied. That's the assumption here, why you spend X amount of time speaking about the Bible comparative to, for example, the Bhagavad Gita. Well,
it could be just that's his, this is a Western.
Yeah, but so is Hercules tradition. And so is Zeus, right? That's Western as well, right? Mithraism, I mean, that's Western
that's
as well.
That's how it's projected now, back projected, it's claimed. Yeah, you know?
But the point is, these are myths that he's chosen, aside from other myths, and other Western myths at that, right? Having said all of, and by the way, sorry to say, Christianity is not a Western religion. It starts
Western Middle East. Christianity.
Yeah, but Christianity started off in the Middle East. If you wanted something cleanly Western, then the ancient Greek tradition is more. No, it is.
Yeah.
Because, Jesus Christ was a Middle Eastern man, right? They worship a Middle Eastern man. So let's not lose sight of where Christianity actually started, which is in the Middle East, in Jerusalem and in these places, Bethlehem. Anyway, the point is, why these myths and not others, for whatever reason, yeah? There must be some added value of these myths and not other myths. But then, the question is, how are we going to exegete the Bible? If we exegete it all as mythological, then it's, for all intents and purposes, not true. But remember, he's a pragmatist. And there's a reason, this is
a conspiracy. Those bits that have some,
I don't want to be conspiratorial. I do not want to be conspiratorial here. Yeah, but if you're a pragmatist, then you accept different kinds of truth. But if you accept different kinds of, so you're able to accept the religious truth as a separate substratum of different kinds of truth. But he's a pragmatist when it comes to this, as I've mentioned, but clearly not when it comes to even speaking about language itself. He speaks about language in correspondence terms. He speaks about
and he's very he seems to be very anti deconstructionism, and that some argue posit, you know, argue against
pragmatism. Okay, against, let me put this closer to the mind, right? Pragmatism, neo-pragmatism, people like Richard Rorty, who are the foremost proponents of it, are the neo-pragmatists of today. People like Susan Hack, who's written Critical Inquiry, she's a neo-pragmatist. Historically, there was a group of people called the American Pragmatists in the early 20th century. They kind of started off, if you like, the method, the school of thought. So pragmatism is like that. Now, if you're a pragmatist, you don't believe in a truth that is out there. Okay, Richard Rorty, who is one of the foremost pragmatists of today, was also a postmodernist. Just to put this in perspective.
Because they tend to go...
Yeah, he's a foremost postmodernist, and he's a foremost pragmatist. Can you see the tension here? Jordan Peterson, in other places of his book, he attacks postmodernism because postmodernism clearly is against kind of the conservative values, which he espouses in other places. He doesn't call it that. And once again, it wouldn't be right to call him a conservative. All these caveats in place. Mm-hmm. Yet, he's clearly against postmodernism, clearly. And he's clearly against nihilism. But his pragmatist views are actually so commensurate with those things that it's almost inconceivable to try and differentiate.
Contradissonance, like you said, he's holding to...
Yes, opposing. So I actually think that Richard Dawkins and others must think about whether or not they are cognitively dissonant. Because on the one hand...
You said Richard Dawkins.
Did I say so? Jordan Peterson. Because when he said that time, when he was speaking to Sam Harris, when Sam Harris said to him, it will be at your peril, and he said, it has been at my peril. What does it mean when he said, in the first person, it has been at my peril? That means to say that he's already found this stuff hard to conciliate. And that it's causing him discomfort, which is an exact definition, practically, of cognitive dissonance.
Which is where you come in with the go rap.
Which is where we come in as Muslims and say, there's a solution to this problem, which is a firm anchorage, 1, 2, 3, which I've already explained to him in the discussion. Yeah. But we have to first diagnose the issue a bit more. And that's why I do think, that there is added value in the Islamic discourse, which Christianity cannot actually compete with it. So this has got to be, we'll talk about him, why people gravitate towards him, because he's an anchor in the age of chaos. And there's truth in that. He offers rules and organization and all these kind of self-controlled tactics. Yeah. That's all true and good. But he hasn't yet sorted out his own epistemology.
Yeah.
He himself is in peril, according to his own discussion. So,